We'll get started on our next session. Our next one is on titled Case Study, 30 Years of Sustaining High Plains Groundwater with Wastewater Irrigation. Fred Vasasek from Servitec Laboratories and Charles Nicholson, Nicholson Ventures Farms, will be talking with us.
Well, good morning, everybody. We're going to try a tag team approach here, and I'm Fred Vasasek. I'm the senior lab agronomist at Servitec. I also represent the CCA program on the Agronomy Society board.
Yes, I'm Chuck Nicholson. I'm over 15 years with CCA. My education is with a lifetime of farming. I've got an ag econ degree and a minor in animal science. And because of this project here, we've also spun off another business called Benaterra, and it's involved with water management solutions for like COVID methane gas and energy industries with water reclamation, injection well, dispersal of water. And I think 2 years ago, our company won Management Company of the Year at the Rocky Mountain Division.
Okay. What we'd like to do is talk about, we're coming on our, the 30th anniversary of, you might say, of the wastewater project in the city of Dodge City. And I'll talk about some of the details and such. And just to put things in perspective, I'm theory and he's practice. I get paid to kind of talk about things. He gets paid to actually do things. So hopefully a good point or counterpoint. This topic falls under the term sustainable agriculture. And I think sustainability is sort of like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. There's a lot of different definitions and different nuances. It is important, an important concept to a lot of people. When they talk about downstream markets, what we're really talking about is the public and the consumers that are out, sort of outside of agriculture, you might say, the final consumers of the food. This is one of many definitions, but for this we'll use it. Employing practices that allow for efficient resource use. Now that's a big umbrella, but I think it sums things up pretty well. And ideally, we would use renewable resources in all cases. Now, we'd be able to perfectly recycle, but that's not the way life is. We have to take a practical view of it. There are limitations. In some cases, we simply can't renew certain things. Or the cost of using a renewable resource or whatever becomes excessive. So we have to balance these things, and that's one of the things we want to talk about today is some of the challenges and the opportunities that, of this system. So I'm going to lay out the groundwork. It's officially called the City of Dodge City Wastewater Recycling Project. Our affectionate shorthand is DCH2O. The little rectangle there illustrates the area I'm talking about or we'll be talking about in Kansas. That's where Dodge City is located. We're in the High Plains, Western High Plains region or Great Plains region. It's a semi-arid environment. It's a temperate environment. And the saying goes, if you don't like the weather in Dodge City, just wait 15 minutes and you'll have a new weather. This just gives you a perspective of Dodge City in relationship with some of the other cities like Kansas City or Oklahoma City. We're a micropolitan area, a ways away from large areas. Now, Dodge City is sort of legendary. It's the stuff of movies, of TV. One of the longest-running TV shows was Gunsmoke, and set in a set that was supposed to represent Dodge City. But the truth is, Dodge City is really a cow town. Since about the 1880s, the railhead was built and started transporting cattle from Texas. The cattle drives, they're loaded at Dodge City, and then they're taken to Kansas City and Chicago for slaughter for use by consumers. And it still is, that's a real mainstay of our local economy. This little triangle I've shown from Dodge City to Garden City to Amarillo, Texas, inside of that triangle, about 40% of all the beef in the United States gets produced. So it's really our economy is centered around livestock, and it has been for a very long time.
These older pictures are probably very reflective of what was going on at that time, because my first involvement with wastewater there in the city of Dodge City was As a high school student, they took us on a tour out to the wastewater site, and it consisted of just round tanks with rocks covered with maggots, and they were just pouring water over it, so it was very antiquated. And back when I was in high school, it was the big hair days. And I remember my instructor turning around, and there was a guy that was too close, had a rock full of maggots, turned and hit him right in the head, and his first thing was to get down on the ground and was getting all the maggots out of it. So that was my first experience with this wastewater project that was antiquated, that the EPA was requiring something different to happen, and that's how we got involved with it.
Now, one of the important things about this project, and I think you can have a disposal site or a recycling project, and there are some critical elements that can separate the two. And I think a really important component of this overall project is the partnership, and I'll go through some of the project partners here. Of course, City Dodge City, its municipality, has to deal with wastewater like anybody else. One of the partners is National Beef Packers. There's a large packing plant that is sort of within the city limits, you might say, but it's a major employer and also a major partner in this endeavor. CH2M is an international environmental engineering and consulting firm. They manage the wastewater facilities. The city owns them, but CH2M is contracted to manage and deal with those facilities. Of course, we have Nicholson Ventures, the farming operation that receives the wastewater and uses it for crop production. And then I'd like to say last and certainly hopefully not least, but we have a couple of different consultants. Noel Teammeyer is a crop consultant, works with Chuck on a day-to-day basis in the management of the operation. And then Servitech, we've served as, you might say, an environmental consultant, taking a look at more long-term issues and involved with this. But this partnership becomes important because it's each partner has different needs. Each partner brings different things to the table. It provides a system of checks and balances. Most days it works pretty good. There's some days there's a little bit of friction here or there, as people work things through. But it's been really critical to have that working partnership and have good open lines of communications to make this successful.
In this slide, we're just showing that I am a third-generation farmer. Upon graduation, I came immediately back to the farm. My desire was to be a ski bum for one season, but my father, in his infinite wisdom, thought it would probably cause too much direction change for my course. But in the meantime, since I've been back at the farm, I've had a sister that had come back to the farm that's working with us, and she was a product manager for Oscar Mayer. Her claim to fame was the Lunchables. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. That was her product she brought up. She was also product brand manager for Kloss and Pickle, and that claim to fame was putting the refrigerated pickles in the aisles of the grocery store. And upon that time, I have a son that's come back, graduated from K-State. We sent him to Australia for a season to work there before he came back. And here just recently, I had a daughter that came back that was she was director of operations for Grand Canyon Airlines. She's a pilot, and she just came back here in the last 2 months. So this legacy and leaving this farm and being sustainable is very important for my family.
Okay, one of the project partners is National Beef Packers, and their annual harvest, there's about 1.5 million head of fed cattle that go through that plant. And that results in roughly 900 million pounds of dressed beef exported annually. Now, one of the things that's important to remember about the packing industry is that very little goes to waste. The joke is that the only thing that doesn't get recycled or get used is the moo of the cattle. But bone meal, for example, is used as a fertilizer, phosphate fertilizer. The tallow from the operation is combined with the byproducts from ethanol production, and it's repurposed and used for livestock feed supplement. Even blood plasma is taken and processed, and it is a very common food ingredient, a smoothing and thickening agent. This is a view of the wastewater facilities. They're south of town. Again, this is managed by CH2M. The water is considered to be secondary treated. about 6 million gallons a day, not quite 6 million gallons a day average inflow, and a little over 2 billion gallons per year. The facility itself has a capacity of over 1 billion gallons of storage, and there's 184 acres of surface area in the project. Now, this project has won a number of awards. It's been awarded by EPA, and it's the Kansas Water Environment Association has given it the Plant of the Year 14 times in the last 30 years. So it's held up as a model for a number of other operations. In the background, a little white dot there, that's Dodge City there. And the wastewater is transported about 10 miles. There's a series of pipelines and brought south of town. So it's the waters, and we'll talk about that in just a minute.
If you're out on our site, there'll be something that's unique about it. You can be out there and you won't smell any odor. The pond and the surface area is critical out there because in Dodge City, we're also known for our wind. We actually lead Chicago in the amount of wind that's generated. So wind action, sunlight, is very critical for a continued breakdown of the surface water that we use to pump with.
This is a schematic and sort of a historical perspective of the progress of this project. Now, up until 1983 or so, City of Dodge City and I might mention National Beef utilizes a municipal wastewater system. Not every plant does that. Many of them have their own system. So this is a bit of a unique situation. But it went to the old wastewater treatment facility and it was treated as Chuck talked about. And it was simply discharged in the bed of the Arkansas River. And the Arkansas River can be described in Dodge City as an intermittent stream. So then in 1985, there was a facility constructed about 10 miles south of town, anaerobic digestion. There were a series of two aerobic treatment ponds and storage lagoons established. Some pipelines were laid and connected some of the center pivots on the operation to that facility. Now, a few of those pivots were connected directly and they only had access to wastewater. A larger share of those could be switched back and forth between wastewater and groundwater. A few of them were groundwater facilities, and there was also structures or they're allowed to bring in groundwater to dilute the wastewater and maintain the wastewater quality. And so this operated for a number of years. And then we'll talk about it a little later, but in 2004, there was a significant expansion of the facility. Additional storage ponds were constructed and more aerobic facilities. The wastewater, or the groundwater was disconnected or was disconnected from the pivots, and now the groundwater it serves as a source of potable water for the National Beef Packers and their sanitation operations and processing. Okay. I guess I'd make a comment. One of the things is there is, it seems to me, a lot of risk to disconnect the groundwater from these pivots just simply because suddenly you were strictly dependent on the wastewater side of it. Now, what this did, if you think of it sort of schematically, this is a closed loop on our resources. And this is true for any municipality. We have a source of potable water, whatever that is. It's the municipality brings it into the city. It's used by various industries, various users. The water is used, generated, and then we generate a source of wastewater. That wastewater is then treated. By law, it has to be treated to a certain level. Maybe it has to be treated to a secondary level. Some facilities treat it to a tertiary level. And then very often it's discharged into surface water, a stream, a river or a lake or whatever. And depending on biological breakdown and to finish doing the final process, treatment process. And so fundamentally, this project is not much different from that. Instead of discharging the surface water, the water is stored and it's treated by land application. But what makes it a bit unique is now that that water is used for crop production. And I show here, you know, theoretically it could serve as a source of recharge water and loop back into the city. But probably more so it frees up the groundwater for municipal use rather than being used for crop production.
What's also unique about this, if you look at all the people that's involved with this, is that they're trying to get rid of water, but we're not just thinking about using the land for a disposal source, because we have a vested interest to keep that very good and productive to get revenue off of it. And because the city and National Beef is also harvesting water underneath of us, everybody has a vested interest to be doing the right thing to keep this a viable and not just a dumping ground.
I think that vested interest is a great a great comment. Now, one of the ways the process has changed since 1985 is the land area has been expanded and roughly doubled in land area, and we'll talk about that a bit. But this is an aerial view of the various pivots that are connected. You see the blue circles, that's the location of the treatment ponds. North or up in the map, about 10, 12 miles north of the city of Dodge City. So it's about 5 miles from north to south and about 2.5 miles from east to west. So it's a lot of pipeline and a lot of facilities here.
And like, I just want to iterate that we had owned the ground before and we were already irrigating before, and us being a part of this project was being able to transfer the water rights that went to the city of Dodge City and National Beef. So that was our exchange in this whole process.
I think that's important. Just but Kansas law, if you are the landowner, you also have water rights. In Kansas, the water is considered the property of the people of the state of Kansas, and you actually have a right. You have to you're granted a right to use it for irrigation, for use it for domestic or industrial purposes. So those water rights can be transferred back and forth, and that's a bit different from some other states. One of the challenges was simply managing the wastewater flows. This shows from 1987 to 2015 a pretty steady and linear increase in wastewater flows over time, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the population of Dodge City increased by about 1.5 times from during that time. So there are just more, you know, more showers being taken, more toilets being flushed, that sort of thing. But also, National Beef did a significant expansion, and prior to the expansion of the wastewater facility, this all went hand in hand. When the project began, the majority of the wastewater flows, 83%. Was from the municipal side and only 17% from the National Beef Packers. Today, it's more like about 40% municipal, and the majority of the water comes from the National Beef Packers. So this has created some challenges and had to make some adjustments and adaptations. Now, one of the things we did was we increased the land area, and we're showing the increase year to year to year of the number of acres that were irrigated with the wastewater. So we've tried to keep up with the wastewater flows by expanding the land area. But again, that there's an investment there because we have to lay pipelines and valving and do all the things necessary to deliver a reliable source of water. When I went back through the records and totaled up, we have metered about 34 billion gallons of water that has been used, of wastewater that has been used for irrigation. And going back to the municipal water history, that's over 60% of the total water, municipal water, used by the city of Dodge City. So for every 2 gallons of municipal water that was utilized by, for whatever reason, a domestic or industrial use, a little over a gallon of that was returned back, not discharged, but returned back and used for crop production.
Earlier on the slide that Fred showed, that National Beef provides 60% of the water. When you look at the industrial use, normally they use that water harder, so the BOD's loading is higher, And we've been using as a dilution the municipal water because their loading isn't quite as high, and we've been using that as a dilution factor for the industrial part, so that's been a good combination for us.
So what did we get for that 34 billion gallons of water? I couldn't go back. We didn't have records back all 30 years, but I was able to go back about 20 years. That water was used to produce about 5.5 million bushels of corn, 71,000 tons of alfalfa, 47,000 tons of corn silage, over 5,000 bushels of grain sorghum, almost 50,000 bushels of soybeans, and 68,000 bushels of wheat. Okay, so instead of being simply discharged, we were able to use that water to produce this. Now, what does that mean to the consumer? So what? So I tried to go through and do some rough estimates. If that alfalfa was part of a dairy program, it would have been responsible for producing about 5 to 10 million gallons of milk. If all the wheat had been ground and used for bread, that would be 6 million loaves of whole wheat bread, which would make roughly 55 million sandwiches if you didn't count the bread ends. Something over a quarter of a million quarts of soybean oil. And if the corn were part of a cattle ration, it would have produced about 70 million pounds of dressed beef. And as I mentioned before, there are other byproducts. One of the byproducts is the hide, is the leather. And the number of cattle that would have raised would produce somewhere around 650,000 pairs of cowboy boots, or if you're an urban cowboy, 115,000 leather car seats. So the auto manufacturers and our local packing plant have a vested interest in each other.
It also goes to show you that instead of just being considered wastewater, our water is being reused in a way that's so beneficial in our own small community to regenerate production going through the facility, saving money, and just jobs, money. It all stays right there in the community, and that's what's important for us.
Now, one of the challenges is just dealing with, we talked a bit, Brian and Neil's presentation a bit earlier. We have to look at, when we're dealing with irrigation, there's a balancing act that goes on because we have precipitation, irrigation, and we've got to make sure it all comes out right. This is the normal irrigation pattern. Dodge City, again, receives about over 21 and a half inches of annual rainfall. And of course, most of it occurs in the summer months, little in the winter months. Well, if we throw on top of that an irrigation requirement, our water needs increase substantially. So the original intent of the project and one of the opportunities was to have a source of additional irrigation water to help fill in the gap between what the precipitation provided and what was required by the irrigation. One of the challenges is dealing with extremes. These are the dots represent some of the historic over the last 30 years. Every now and then we have a huge, really, really wet month, 4 or 8 inch rain, something. So the system has to be flexible enough to be able to accommodate these extremes, not only the averages, but also deal with the extremes.
In our ponds, we have basically a 4 month holding capacity. So it's my responsibility to have them at a level low enough by the 1st of December that we can hold 4 months because we have freezing weather during the winter, and it's very hard to pump water above ground when you got freezing weather going on. So at the 1st of March, end of February, we're generally having to start pumping. So I've had to adapt different types of crops that can take water at different times of the year. And it's kind of interesting going back to Brian and Neil's presentation. There's times on the end when I don't have enough water because, like, there's years that we've had 30 inches of rainfall versus a year where we had 9 inches. I cannot figure in that kind of an extreme. So we've purposely abandoned some crops that are more drought tolerant that can take it without water. Well, we've also timed it where we've backed off on some watering on the corn during the vegetative growth and just then had enough to make to the reproductive growth so we can finish that crop. So we've been doing some balancing because not that we chose to at the beginning, but we've been forced to just because the environment had changed its plans on us.
Just to sort of illustrate the point here, the regulatory requirement, Kansas Department of Health and Environment is our state EPA. Their requirement is to have a minimum of 90-day storage. And the idea was you have to watch the levels within that storage, and you have to maintain a certain level or a freeboard, which is be the distance between the top of the storage and the top of the water surface, and you have to accommodate one of those extreme events. And so that's the way that most facilities, this one was constructed, and a lot of facilities are constructed to the regulatory minimum. Well, here's what can happen in a situation like that. With the original, the pre-2004, the original construction, it wasn't hard with a wet winter with some of those extra waters to exceed the storage capacity by 1.5 or better. And so, as Chuck said, we had to irrigate off-season. So we had to drain the storage down. I say we, but had to irrigate to pull the storage down. So we were irrigating in March and April before any crop was really planted or there was any crop to really utilize the water. Then in late summer, when our irrigation demand was greater than what was already in storage and what the inflows were, it required some extra water. So in August, a time of peak irrigation, it was easy to run out of water. And so this created some challenges. And currently, the current storage volume is roughly 2 times the regulatory requirement. And that's expensive. Storage is very expensive to construct and maintain. And I've been involved in some projects, and the engineers are looking at, and the facility, the people building the facility, obviously want to keep the cost down. And if we comply with regulatory requirements, that's quite different. This facility now was constructed, when we looked at the expansion, we tried to take a look at agronomic requirement. What is it going to take, not just to meet the minimum regulatory requirement, but to provide for good crop production and provide enough water to maintain our crop growth.
Fred, I may have jumped a slide ahead when I spoke last time, but one of the things that we've tried to do to help mitigate that is I've got different types of crops that use water at different peak times, whereas like alfalfa, we can start watering on that early because it has a storage on it. And then late in the season behind the corn, I've got cover crops that go in with radishes. We've been doing some grazing. We've got it rotating with sorghum, so we can hit the different times. And like I said, the crops have different water needs and that can take the drought tolerance better than others. So that's how one of the ways that we help mitigate this effect.
The other thing that is a big challenge is just that the water quality, the wastewater quality, changes over time. It changes from historically, it's changed from month to month, may change from week to week. The dot diagrams, the XY graphs I have here, show time on the bottom, the progression over 30 years, and the dots represent the wastewater monitoring. So the top set of lines, or top set of dots represents, or points represents, the sodium absorption ratio. And salinity was our first challenge facing with the wastewater. In the early, now they've modified the procedures, but National Beef Packers, as many other facilities do, they use sodium chloride salt for hide curing. And at the end of the shift, at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, those hide vats were dumped into the city wastewater stream. And so we got this big surge of salt through the day. And so that was the first challenge we had to take a look at and the first problem that was observed. We didn't really get involved until the first full year of operation with this. And at that time, noticed some, Noel Tiemeyer, the consultant, noticed there was a problem, noticed some crop damage, and so went back and established what we're talking about today. But you see the sodium absorption ratio slowly and steadily increased. The arrow represents the time when the expansion occurred. National Beef has modified their hide procedure, and so our salt levels have dropped off. The next challenge we faced was nitrogen. The nitrogen loads from all the organic materials that are discharged into the wastewater stream change is it's highly variable, and so that creates a challenge. It'd be great to know that there's a certain level of nitrogen in every inch of water that's used, but it's really hard to deal with and hard to manage. So you have to be real flexible and very adaptable to deal with this. Well, one of the things that was set in early on was a soil monitoring plan. And I'd like to point out that from 1985, from the initiation of that project until the expansion in 2004, there was a certain operating permit. And there was no regulatory requirement for soil sampling. So there was no soil sampling. There was waste effluent sampling required, but not soil sampling. From 2004 until now, or continuing on, the current permit only requires soil sampling to a depth of 2 feet. But early on in the project, the partners recognized we had to take a more extensive look at that. So I want to talk about the soil monitoring plan here and some of the things we've learned from it. The graphs here, the box and whisker graphs, are a summation of annual soil sampling, looking at the exchangeable sodium concentration from 55 of our monitoring sites, and we sample these spring and fall, 55 sites across the project. And there's, if you can detect a trend in there, your eyes are better than mine, things change. Weather changes may change the evaporation. You may have more or less water being applied, different crops. And so you have to constantly monitor this and make sure that we're on top of it. So surface soil sample, we pay attention to the top 6 inches because we're concerned about the effect of the sodium on the water infiltration. Now we manage that by routine applications of gypsum. Every year, and this is an expense that the city of Dodge City has, is they have a vested interest in maintaining the productivity. And so each year, about 1,000 acres of the project receives a gypsum application. It receives calcium sulfate, displaces the sodium, and then hopefully flush the sodium through the profile, but maintain the soil permeability.
Well, at those periods when we had high SAR readings, as far as a practical part of it, we were having a great difficulty or challenges with water infiltration, as you could figure that the salts was tying up the particles and was allowing it to run off and stuff, and our yields were suffering accordingly in very stark contrast to our freshwater wells. And between the gypsum application, and we changed some ways that we did farming. I was heavily into ridge till, and we cleaned between the rows there, and we'd in-row rip just so we could hold the water. And we got to finding out that the strip till was actually a better source of a field incorporation for us, as it allowed water to move through. We kept the residue there to help mitigate the effects of the evapotranspiration. Just having the material in there act as a way to wick the water into the ground. And we were able to use that as a way to break up some of the pans behind when we put in a cover crop there that we grazed it. It opened up where we were allowed to put the cattle on there, and also it really helped our yields, and it was a dramatic improvement for us.
I might point out that when we looked at the picture, obviously Kansas is actually flatter than a pancake, but many of the slopes on this across this these fields here are 1, perhaps 2% slopes, but there are areas with 6, 8, 10% slopes, not a lot of it. So runoff is a concern, and so managing that runoff with the gypsum and with the tillage, it became a really important component. We also sample to depths of 5 and 10 feet. We take, I might point, incremental samples. We take samples once a year now to a depth of 10 feet, take them 1 foot at a time. And what we were looking at was we found evidence of preferential flow. What sort of what triggered this initially was to monitor nitrates, but one of the things we noticed was that certain soils seem to accumulate sodium a bit faster. Now, most of the soils in this project are Harney and Ulysses soils, silt loam, silty clay loam texture, mollisols, prairie grass. The pictures you see are a study that the Kansas Geologic Survey and Kansas State conducted, and a dye tracer study, and simply put an impoundment on the soil surface, filled it with water and a blue vegetable dye, waited 24 hours, and then dug a pit. The one, I guess, to your left would be a Harney soil. That's the Kansas State soil. And the dye streaks there represent the root channels, the rooting patterns within that soil. And it's very very easy to see that about a foot and a half down is a change in the horizon. It's a denser clay, has a higher clay content, less root proliferation. And then down 3 feet down, you see the roots begin to proliferate again. And what we think was happening here was there was sort of a perching going on, and so that sodium was not being mobilized through the profile in the Harney soil in the same way it was through the Ulysses soil. The picture on your right is sort of interesting. This illustrates what's called funnel flow, and as I understand this field, before it had only been irrigated about 3 years when this picture was taken, but prior to that time, if I understand what Chuck has told me, the farmer there grew wheat, and he used bindweed as a cover crop. And our thoughts were that this funnel flow, this is really a bindweed root channel. And if you look at the pattern, you would have an area of perhaps 3 or 4 feet in diameter collecting water, rainfall, or precipitation. But by the time we got down to 4, 5, 6 feet, suddenly all of that water was focused into an area that was just a few inches across. And so the hydraulic head, the pressure would be more intense, and so the water would move a lot faster than we normally would assume. This profile sampling illustrated, showed us challenges with nitrogen loading. Early on in the project, as I showed that wastewater was expanding, the plant was just operating well above design capacity, and so the treatment was not as effective as it could have, as we would have liked to have had. But this diagram here illustrates an area that was developed for irrigation. It had been in pasture grass for many years, and we were, at that time, the nitrogen loading was hard to estimate, but it was easily 2 times the crop removal rate. And so what we saw was this accumulation. As you go to year 1, year 2, year 3, and year 4, you see these nitrate, and that's we're showing nitrate concentration with depth, incremental depth. We saw these nitrate-enriched zones developing and creating a pattern with, and this happens to be irrigated corn. And it makes sense when you... this pattern makes sense when you sort of think about the soil type and the characteristics of a crop. We look at corn, and we talk about how corn, of course, can root in good conditions down to 5 to 6 feet, but the effective rooting zone is about in the top 3 feet, most of it in the surface. And that top 3 feet sort of accounts for this depleted zone. It's a zone of greatest root activity. And this is the zone, you might say, the soil horizon of agronomic concern, because the water and the nutrients in that 3-foot profile are really what contribute to yield. That's the money maker. But we have this enriched zone below that, in the fringes of the active rooting zone. That's the environmental issue, because if we don't have a way of capturing that nitrate, it can continue to move on downward and get it. Possibly get into the groundwater.
Well, we have corn and alfalfa production, and because of the nitrogen loading, and you're thinking of alfalfa as a legume that produces its own nitrogen. Well, we've come to find out with Fred's soil sampling and testing that when we put alfalfa out there, it uses the nitrogen luxuriously, meaning that it was harvesting nitrogen down 15, 20, 25 feet down, and we were putting it back up on the surface. So we were actually cleaning up the profile. So that's why we have that alfalfa in our mix with our crop production.
You might the profitability between corn and alfalfa.
Yeah, for us, our profitability lies more with the row crops. Alfalfa can be kind of a drag because we don't have it at a size that's viable because we don't own the harvest equipment. We always hire it done. So it's really, we use it as a stewardship to help clean up the soil, even though it isn't the best benefit for us economically.
And just roughly, Chuck talked about the rotation. Over the years, roughly three-fourths of the project is in row crop, and about a fourth of the crop is in alfalfa, and we rotate that around periodically. This is, we commenced in 1992 into 2013. We picked certain of the sites, and we moved them around a little bit, but we were taking samples down, soil samples, again, incremental samples down to depths of 30 and 50 feet. To take a look at what was going on. So this was in the upper Bato zone. The pictures there to your right are soil cores from those locations. We used the Gidding soil probe. We had a 2-inch coring tube, so we would bring up an intact soil core. Now the circles are showing little pinholes that we find in the soil core. We assume these are root channels because they darken up probably from root exudates, and we expected to find those in 3 and 4 feet and maybe 8 to 10 feet, but we found them at depths of 30 and 50 feet. Maybe not a lot of them, but in a 2-inch core you'd find 4 or 5 or 6. And what we attribute this to is native grass prairie, that over a period of hundreds of years that grass root system penetrated slowly, inch by inch, but was able to penetrate down into the soil profile. So we have we have this preferential flow issue, and we have the soil macropores. And so, yeah, but, it's a long way to groundwater. We hear that. People talk about that a lot. Under the project, depending on where you're located, it may be at 100 to 200 feet to the groundwater surface. The lithology of the area, we've got lus cap to depths of 70 to 90 feet, and below that is sand and gravel. That's our Oglala aquifer, and there's some interbedded clay layers within that. Now, if to look at the diagram, when we sampled to 50 feet and the samples that we took there, we only had about 20, 30, 40 more feet through the lus before we hit a very permeable layer. So if we have nitrate movement through that 30 and 50 foot, or through that 50 foot zone, once it got past 50 feet, it got into an area where it could move very, very quickly into the groundwater. And again, this is what we see over time, and because of the variable wastewater, we see these nitrate-enriched zones develop, and these are illustrations of 30-foot soil sampling in progressive years. And what we see is we see these nitrate-enriched zones sort of moving down because we have these are permanent monitoring sites, and I didn't really have a good way to quantify them. I circled one there in 2011. That was the beginning of a very severe drought. The 2012, it moved up into the Corn Belt and the northern areas, but our drought started in 2011. And so we had above normal, below normal precipitation, above normal irrigation, above normal evapotranspiration. Treatment was a bit different, so we got a big accumulation that year and had to deal with that. But these nitrate-enriched zones appear to be moving downward at speeds of about 3 to 5 feet a year under the irrigation. And I thought, there's just a thimble full of information out there. People have done controlled studies, but that's consistent with the 2 or 3 studies I've been able to find under irrigation in the plains. So so the travel time, even at 70 feet, we're talking 20 years or 15 years of travel time before it would move through the profile and potentially enter into the permeable zone of the aquifer. So we use this to sort of monitor and develop. And I might point out, this was fairly consistent observation with this. We took a look at alfalfa, and Fowler did the same thing tracking alfalfa, and the graph to your left is the year that alfalfa was planted, or that you're following the alfalfa planting, the year before alfalfa planting. So we have an enriched nitrate zone left over from corn or whatever is being produced. But we see a slow and progressive depletion of nitrate through the profile. Now, is it gone? I'm not sure. It's immobilized, taken up. It doesn't show up. And we see this, again, we saw depths to 5 to 10 feet depletion, but we see depths after 5 or 6 years of alfalfa in these soils, we're seeing depletion down to 20, 30, and 40 feet. And by the time, if we can take the alfalfa to 7 years or so, there's very little profile nitrate through the entire profile. So that was the reason for introducing alfalfa into the rotation. Even though from a profitability standpoint, labor management standpoint, it's sort of a liability. But we use the alfalfa as a crop to mitigate the nitrate accumulations. Okay. Now, one of the things that comes into play is savings of irrigation energy. Our depth of groundwater is about 100 to 200 feet. These are highly efficient irrigation systems. We utilize as much new technology as possible, drop nozzle, low pressure nozzle, wobblers, and there's been some experimentation over time with irrigation equipment, and some of the experiments maybe didn't work as well as others, but one of the things to remember that the greatest amount of energy in irrigation is required to lift the water from the ground to the land surface. And I took a little, calculator that Kansas State had put together. If we had 150 feet average lift, and that 30 years of irrigation, we calculated the amount of natural gas that it would have taken to move all that water from the aquifer up to the land surface, because once you get it above ground, pushing water takes a lot less energy than lifting water. Essentially, we repurposed 355 million cubic feet of natural gas. That was not used for irrigation. Now, it may have been used for something else, but that freed up that much natural gas. And to put that in perspective, using the energy consumption or natural gas consumption of the average U.S. household, that's enough gas for one household to heat and cook for about 4,800 years. So, very, very significant savings.
The savings on natural gas is one reason why we were using to kind of figure how we were going to bid on this project to get it out of our place. So, what's happened is that we've saved all this natural gas here, and on the next slide you'll see that the city of Dodge City's this project produces methane gas off the anaerobic lagoons, and they're getting ready to put in a facility there to interject and clean up that gas and put it right back into the pipelines. And National Beef is capitalizing on it because now they're getting carbon credits for gas that's being produced by this that's being put back on there. So it's reaped benefits in ways that we didn't foresee at the time that we bid on the project.
Yeah, of course, anaerobic digestion, we generate methane. Shane Smith, the project manager, said that during the summer months, they generate about 63 million cubic feet of methane. And at the current time, that's just flared off. Those flares, there's a flare on each pond. Highway 283 runs, half a mile, quarter mile east of these ponds. So at night, it's kind of a dramatic thing as you're driving along, and all of a sudden you see this big flame in the air. But within a year or so, that is going to cease, and scheduled for March of 2018, they plan to capture, and they estimate 600 to 700 million cubic feet of raw gas. And the yield from that raw gas is approximately 72% methane. And so that's going to be brought back into the pipeline system and simply add to our natural gas supply. So So again, we've saved energy, but we've also generated energy from this process.
We use cattle in a way to harvest some of the cover crops and stuff that we have in between times when we have as a way to harvest some of the water at off-peak times. But it's also kind of neat to think about that, how this loop works in that not only are they sending us water, but we're raising crops and beef that goes right back to the plant, and it just keeps circulating and just adding value to the community.
So we talked earlier about a resource closed loop. We're talking about here is an economic closed loop. And there is an expense involved, expense in mobilizing, moving wastewater around, expense involved in the wastewater treatment facility, the treating of the certainly there's a regulatory cost because there are things that have to be installed or dealt with that might not contribute to management, but they are required from a regulatory standpoint. And in this project also, there was an additional expense, an additional investment in that extra storage and piping and some of those kinds of things. Now, many of those expenses would be accrued just simply by any city. Dodge City is probably a little bit above normal, but this is something that every city, every small town, every village faces is dealing with wastewater. But we talk about an economic closed loop. If we take the crops that were produced, typically they're marketed through livestock or livestock production, dairy or beef production, and it generates an income stream. So we have cost savings from the irrigation, use of water. We've been able to capture nutrients, and you might mention that, water and energy savings, but also revenue, direct revenue from the crop production, from sales of crop commodities, from the sale of livestock. But then as it circulates in the community, some sort of indirect revenues for additional employment, tax revenue, and so it's and then that returns and that helps offset some of those expenses. So it is a closed loop. You might mention your fertilizer use and approach that.
One of the benefits that we're using is that we're having the crops harvest the nutrients that's being produced by the wastewater. There's another plant that Dodge has that mechanically removes the phosphorus and the nitrogen. I mean, those are both products that we need and use in our crops. And we didn't talk about the economic benefit for the city of Dodge City, you know, just by having this process. That other process costs them 10 times a gallon more to do than what our process of just open flow and we're doing the harvesting. When they're physically extracting those nutrients out of the water, it's cost them 10 times more. So the city has benefited over the years as the EPA regulations have changed over the years, and other cities, municipalities that harvest the nutrients out of there have had to reconfigure and add mechanical items to their processes to clean it up, and their water, you know, costs had just continually gone up. The city of Dodge City hasn't had to change it because we were doing all the harvesting, and we were cleaning it up, and we were doing it for a fraction of the cost of what the city of Dodge City would have had to spend anyway.
I guess in summary, the goals of the project and what we strive to do is to capture and recycle that municipal water and turn it into beneficial use instead of just being a disposal site. We try to capture and recycle the nutrients and use them in crop production. A real important goal is to maintain the crop productivity, and that's the difference between having a recycling site and a waste disposal site. We need to maintain not only the soil but the water quality. Those are our environmental issues. But most importantly is to maintain profitability. If the project is not profitable at some level, we start cutting corners. One of the things that's important to monitor the project and all the processes, and that's geographically, in this case we showed you monitoring with depth, and monitor over time, monitor all different aspects of it, not just the minimum regulatory requirements. We've gone over and above what those regulatory requirements are, and to use that extra, that investment in terms of management. So sustaining this project required these four things. A partnership. That partnership is important. It's critical. It required investment. Sustainability does, there's a cost to it. It's very seldom are we able to do things for free. We have to be flexible, and flexible sometimes very, very quickly to adapt to very short-term changes. And again, profitability. If we don't generate profits, we simply can't make the investments necessary to make this project sustainable and meet those original goals.
Even though we've been doing this for 30 years, and yes, we were green before it was popular to be green, we were doing this because it was important to us to be good stewards around us and not to think that we have it. I mean, we've got it down. There's things that's always coming up. Things change. There's new technologies that come out, and we're willing and ready to adapt to do the best management practices that's needed.
And with that, we're at an end here, so we'll open it up. I guess if there's any questions.
You're not wanting us to solve this today, are you? When I came back, 1983, that was a topic that was we were thinking about. And my father and I decided to bid on this project, not only just because of the cost savings, but for longevity. And we were wanting to associate us with the city of Dodge City because we figured that they're going to be the last people around here that's going to be getting water and acquiring water. Well, we found this as a way to reuse the water and expand our longevity to it. As far as, you know, extending the life of the aquifer, in the first years, they weren't even using our groundwater. And you should see it if you'd look on the Kansas geological sites, that we were actually perching water underneath the ground, underneath the project, and they really couldn't explain it when they were looking at it because they, you know, they were taking water depths and measurements and stuff, and we were, you know, our water was building in there until they had the expansion of National Beef that is now harvesting all our water rights and going back to town. But keep in mind that when National Beef takes our water, there's automatically a 30% cut off the use of the water. So as soon as it switched over to them, their water rights diminished. It was cut off that much of it just because it turned from agriculture use to industrial use. So in one way, that was one way to cut the consumption. Anything you want to say about that, Fred?
Yeah, there's a lot of effort going on, and you know, Governor Brownback, that's been a real focus of his, looking at a 50-year plan. There's some we are in the Southwest Kansas Groundwater Management District, and when I look around the country, it's just I think it's just years ahead of other. When I see the way the water laws are structured in Texas and the issues that are in the southern part of that panhandle, they're just now where Southwest Kansas District was maybe again 30 years ago or so. Long term, that's a big challenge. We have farmers looking at limited irrigation, voluntary cutbacks. I'll give you an example. One, there's a nutritionist in Texas Tech has proposed that we raise, instead of raising corn silage, we raise it's a sorghum, I can't remember what it's called, but it's a sorghum type material for the fiber in the ration, and import corn from the corn belt where it's raised by rain, and so we create corn silage. Livestock production is really important there because of the climate. We don't fight the cold weather, and there's a number of advantages. We don't have people close by. Not everybody wants a livestock operation in their backyard, and they prefer that it be a long distance away. So it's well suited for a low populated area. These are huge issues. We're trying to take care of our little pocket there in southwest Kansas, so we can address that. To address your questions about nitrogen, we really haven't. One of the things that probably reduces the soil nitrogen load is maybe some ammonia loss during the sprinkler irrigation. If we had to contain all of that ammonia, the nitrogen load would be higher. We're aware of that, but we're starting to look at some things proactively, just trying to think ahead. We don't have the answers because we don't necessarily know where the regulations will go. We don't know what's going to be required, and that's part of the challenge, the uncertainty of what do you do and how do you make the investment for something that you have no goal for, or no goal is imposed. So it's on the radar.
No, the solids are all included in the water. I don't know if Fred could pull up that screen, but anyway, on one of the slides, it shows the overview of our lagoon system, and there's a series of lagoons, and it works just like a natural septic system, where we have an anaerobic lagoon, and that's where it comes in, and that's where that gas is coming off, because they've got bugs in there breaking down those solids in there, and I think it stays in those ponds for about 13 days, and it goes into another pond, and you'll see that we have aeration that goes back into the water to put oxygen back in there, and as soon as that gets through there, I think a day or two, then it goes out in the storage lagoon. But the system isn't stopping there, because like I alluded to before, all those particles and stuff there, but in the storage reservoir, we've got the sunlight and the wave action, and it's continuing breaking down some of those nutrients, and time and storage is important to us before we actually pump it out. There's another lagoon in between there that's called the polishing pond, and it goes in there, and we get the oldest water in those reservoirs, so we pump out of those reservoirs and try and keep the youngest water in there as it just goes through those natural processes. So no, there's no grinding or anything, and you'd be surprised to see when you look at municipal waste being put in there. It may be revolting your mind, but you can look down, that water's clear. There's about, 99% of the effluent is all water. Just very few of the solids that's in there. It's surprising when you think about it.
I guess the anecdote I had, we had a tour, and I took a couple of the ASA science policy staff, and one of the places we toured was the Nicholson Farms, and Chuck took us around. We parked on the edge of one of those storage lagoons, the very south edge of the lagoon, and there was a slight northern breeze. And we got out of the pickup, and Chuck said, "You smell that?" And Bethany said, "Smell what?" And Chuck said, "That's my point. There's very little odor, and odor tells you something about that digestion process. The less it's treated, the stronger the odor. And it's now in the early in the early days, there are a lot of complaints locally. People, it could carry for miles, and people would complain. But today, it's just you can't tell.
Well, it's because at the beginning, Fred, that we had engineers think they're pretty smart, and they said that. we didn't need to have covers over top the anaerobic lagoons because it would form its own cover. Well, yeah, we waited and waited, and those covers never did form. So the odor went away as soon as they started covering it and burning off the methane gas. And now we're, like I said, next year we'll be able to harvest that methane gas and put it right back in the pipeline. Yes, we have a lot of data. When this project was installed, one of the requirements is that we had monitor wells put in. I think in every mile we have a monitor well. So, and it's monitored. I mean, I think they take samples of it probably 4 times a year. And yes, there's no nitrogen showing up in aquifer. We have a ways down to it, but that was a requirement when that went in there that they had monitor wells.